Hello, and welcome to Ask an Atheist. We are a weekly educational call-in program dedicated to atheism, skeptical inquiry, and the separation of church and state. We come to you live every Sunday afternoon in Seattle from Scan Studios, and we're archived online at askanatheist.tv. My name is Mike Gillis, and with me this week in the co-pilot chair, Casey Doran.
How's it going, Mike? Good to be here.
Good to be here, too.
Yeah.
You know, given the alternative, it's raining outside.
And that's why we hope you're watching, because you don't have anything better to do, right?
Scan television.
Yes.
Keeps them off the streets. So we have sort of an interesting program today. We don't really have any announcements aside from the usual stuff about Scan TV. As you know, we've mentioned this over the last couple weeks, Scan Studios is in kind of a precarious position. They basically have the contract with Seattle to provide a public access station. However, they have sort of an interesting budget situation. One, there's a huge budget shortfall. It's like $67 million.
Yeah.
And in most of the areas of the country, a cable access network, that does not come from tax dollars. It actually comes from cable franchise fees that Comcast has a deal with the city of Seattle to provide their cable. And as a consequence, that's the thing that Seattle gets out of it, is they said, okay, we'll give you that contract, but part of it is you have to provide an access channel for the community to create their own local programming. That's where Scan comes in. Most places, those franchise fees go directly from the cable subscribers to the channel itself. That's not the case in Seattle. Instead, it goes into the general fund, which means whenever we have a bad economy, a situation sort of like this, we're sort of at the whim of a lot of politicians. But right now we're talking about cutting all sorts of things. So what we need you to do as viewers of a Scan program like Ask an Atheist, we need you to contact the Seattle City Council. Go to scantv.org. Let's get that magical boop right there. There's a lot of information on there, how to contact City Council members. Let them know that you are watching Seattle programming, even if you don't live in the Seattle area, that people are using this service. And public access can be a little weird at times, but I kind of think of it kind of like, you know, public arts funding, that I think it's worth paying for the occasional Bigfoot fake the moon landing show to get to programming like this, because we're one of only two atheist specific television programs in the entire country.
Right, and the most important thing to remember is that this show goes on the air because Scan offers their equipment, training, studio resources for free. So if Scan goes off the air, it means that every show, including ourselves, will either just cease to exist, or will have to find a way to get itself back on the air on the internet and in some other capacity without the aid of the equipment, the training, and the staff and resources here. So it's very important to keep Scan alive.
It really is. And like I said, there's only two programmings like this in the entire country, and they are both on cable access. That if the cable access option is taken away from us, it costs a lot of money to get a show on TV.
Yeah.
That if you look on a lot of Sunday mornings like today, you will see local televangelist preachers like Casey Treat and Mars Hill Church. They have their own TV shows on regular network television, because it's not a lot of people watching TV on Sunday mornings generally.
Right.
But it costs thousands of dollars to get those spots. They have to buy those spots from the local stations. And that's something we generally don't have. Like Casey said, the access to the equipment and the resources here at Scan and the studio is what makes this show possible. So please, please contact them.
Right, yeah. And we don't want to see anyone go off the air unduly, even those people for whose views we think are kooky and crazy. That was it. So the next thing we wanted to go to, I think, was we wanted to do emails first before anything else. So the first one, we just got this yesterday, and this is I take it by analogy, the rule of thumb that people like Michael Pollan always say, where they say, look at the ingredients on the side of the package of food you buy from the grocery store, and if the ingredient you can't pronounce, then you probably shouldn't eat it.
Well, unless you're illiterate. I think at that point, if you know, sugar...
I don't even think you'd be able to do that.
I think you've got bigger problems at that point.
But this, so someone emailed into us, his nickname is Byron, I suppose. He wanted to say that I am a, quote, quasi-panentheistic, Wiccan-based, eclectic neo-pagan. And so far I found your little show, I found very little on your show I've disagreed with.
What is it?
I don't know what a
quasi-panentheistic, Wiccan-based, eclectic neo-pagan. It sounds like you're saying you're kind of pagan. it seems like that's a lot of things that just mean kind of pagan. I really don't know why there's a lot of syllables there that are just kind of surplus.
So quasi panentheistic. So panentheist is what you believe the universe is God.
So is it,
sort of the universe is sort of God.
Is it sort of the universe is God, or is it the universe is sort of God?
I don't know. The only sort of the universe we can know. So we just find that stood out particularly because someone bothered to actually try to structure a series of adjectives out to describe what their belief is, but in the end it comes up to not much. I don't know.
Much.
Don't know what it is. Anyways, his question, he actually says this, anyway, ellipsis, my question is this, total non sequitur. Is it possible that hypothetically speaking, a godlike being could or has evolved? Could evolve or has evolved? So I think the question is, the question that he's really asking is, so our definition of a god is pretty narrow. We think of Yahweh or the monotheistic creator god, one being solely responsible for the entire universe. And he's asking, does this have to be supernatural and magical? Can it, or can it be something that evolved through natural processes? Well, I mean, I don't know what you think about it, Mike, but the way I sort of approach this is, look at that idea of panspermia, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where that's the idea that maybe some sci-fi folks have that say, well, maybe life didn't actually start here on Earth. Maybe interstellar space aliens came by and threw down some, some globs of meat with DNA on it, and then that somehow started itself up and eventually evolved into beings. In that sense, you can say that if in that scenario actually happened and that those beings themselves just evolved from somewhere and became technologically significant, that our gods, our creator gods, could have themselves been creatures that have evolved. But, I mean, it all depends on really what your definition of god or godlike being is.
You're immediately arguing against the sort of Christian definition of a god, the idea of, the wonderful thing about Yahweh is he's the only one.
Right.
But the thing is, if you're going to evolve, people really need to understand that that's not how evolution works. We're not all shapeshifters. I'm not changing from one species into another during the course of my lifetime. Evolution, very simply stated, is change in gene frequencies in a population over time. So for this being to evolve, he has to be part of a breeding population. That means Yahweh can't be the only one. It has to be one of many gods who are breeding and changing and have to be mortal.
Right.
Otherwise, the gene frequency wouldn't change. It doesn't make a lot of sense. So you're immediately sort of taking out the Christian Islamic Yahweh sort of God, Yahweh Allah, that sort of as monotheistic being who is actually there before the creation of the universe. This is something that grew during the course of the universe.
Right.
It doesn't really work. I think, it is possible that you'd have something like Q or Mixius Pitalic or the genie from Aladdin you'd call, godlike something. But again, you're going to get into what it's called Clark's Third Law, which is that any advanced technology, sufficiently advanced, is sort of indistinguishable from magic. Like if I were to go back in time and go hunting with a group of Neanderthals and brought out an AK-47 and took down a mastodon, they would be convinced I had a magic stick. They would have no frame of reference for understanding what I had.
Right. Yeah, and so that's why this question is sort of hard, because it rests on the equivocation of godlike. I mean, even different gods that people actually believe in have differing qualities. I mean, our conception is, as you said, kind of omnipotent, outside of time, creator, that there's only one of them and whatnot. Some people have gods that are a little bit more mundane, that exist in sort of a pantheon of gods, animistic gods that exist in smaller, gods that aren't immortal, I mean, I guess in the Greek mythology, there are some gods that can die, basically, exist.
It seems like they're immortal in the same way that, Tolkien's elves are immortal. They can be killed through violence, but it's not like, Zeus is going to grow old and die. But, I mean, he basically killed his dad.
Right.
And who killed his dad, so, I mean, they
can't
die.
I don't know if there's really an answer. I mean, the answer to the question is, I suppose if we're using the Clarkian definition, another creature in the universe that appears to us godlike because they have technology that we don't, could exist through natural evolution, but that's the hard part to
I'm also not going to make the assumption that something does exist without that positive evidence. I'm not going to simply say, okay, there's a hole in my knowledge, and this hypothetical being could fit into my knowledge, therefore I believe that being actually exists. That's right. Not it. That's basically sort of appeal to ignorance. It's a God of the gap sort of argument. I need positive evidence for something. It's like, I can't say with 100% certainty that unicorns or leprechauns have never at any point in time on any planet anywhere in the universe ever existed. I can't say with 100% certainty they haven't. Mm. However, I don't have any evidence to believe that they have. And once you take that sort of argument, that negative evidence argument, you sort of have to apply it everywhere, and there really is no end to the sort of things that you'd have to believe in, right, including things that are contradictory.
Well, if you believe in things that are contradictory or otherwise strange, the number is 206-421-5658. We'd like to hear what you have to say. If you happen to be a quasi-panentheistic, Wiccan-based eclectic neo-pagan, I think we would definitely do for a little bit of clarification as to what that is.
I don't understand why you need to clarify neo-pagan. It's not like there's a lot of, you know, paleo-pagans that you need, right, to compare. It's not like there's an old-school druid around anymore. That you need
Wait,
to sort of contrast.
I think you wanted to hit on the second half because that was a little.
Yeah. Anyways, this question of could this being have evolved? If so, it wouldn't be out of the question for humanity or another race such as dolphin answer the fair folk. I assume you're referencing Tolkien's elves there because you make some nerd references later. So, brownie points for that, to attain similar status, or more plausibly for us them to create something that would be equal or greater to the hypothetical god being and use it as a bargaining chip against the aforementioned being. Are we talking about Cylons now?
We might be, actually.
Like creating a robot similar to the Vision or Red Tornado and sticking it on Arnold to become president of California. That sentence is awesome, but I have no idea what it means.
I don't know where.
I have no idea what it means.
I don't know what Vision or Red Tornado. Wait, Vision is Vision the character that shoots lasers out of his eyes from?
No, that's Cyclops.
Marvel. No, from Marvel.
Well, he does shoot lasers out of his eyes. Yes, the Vision is an android robot who's a member of the Avengers.
Yeah.
And Red Tornado is a robot who's a member of the Justice League. See, so robot,
This guy's got a superhero team fetish.
Yeah, so, robot superhero. He's not as cool as Ghost Robot from Venture Brothers. So.
No.
So, yeah, anyways, I really don't know what point you're making with the last bit, but that sentence is on its own. Kind of awesome.
Well, thanks, Byron. It was a great email to get.
Do you want
to
do another quick email really quick?
You go for it. Yeah.
Okay. So we have one from Carlos from Mexico. Greetings from Mexico. I first want to say I love your show. It's really awesome. And I'd first like to help me figure out an argument that some believers use to prove the Bible is 100% accurate. Scientific truth. In Isaiah 40:12, they use the word globe to refer to the world. The person who pointed this out to me said that this is proof that the Bible predicts that the earth is round. I know this is a weak argument and it contradicts other verses in the Bible, but I'd like to know what you think about it. First of all, it doesn't say globe. And actually, I think it just, the actual thing, I actually looked this up, just talks about God being able to hold every grain of sand in the world in his hand. It doesn't say anything about globe, but here's the thing, is even if it did, it doesn't prove everything else in the Bible is true, especially the supernatural claims. It doesn't, for instance, you can talk about one thing being accurate in a story that's on the rest of it completely false. Like we were talking about that earlier, like Spider-Man lives in Manhattan. And I can even tell you, in the comic books, what neighborhood Spider-Man lives in. He lives in Queens. That's a real place. However, a lot of the other stuff in the Spider-Man stories aren't true. The same way that Sherlock Holmes lives in London.
Right.
He lives in a real city, and they even reference real places in those stories because the writers of these stories lived in those places. Just because the Bible gets one point right, like you said, it also contradicts another place where they say there was a character
four
in the Bible.
And stuff, right?
Yes, there's a character who stands on a mountaintop and is able to see the four corners of the world, and the earth is immobile and held up by pillars. It gets so many other things so dead wrong. They also think that pi is 3.
But also it's part of this strange thing about translation as well too. So when we're identifying a particular word and it has a loaded meaning, like so, his claim for example is. It's globe, and a globe is a word that we associate with a spherical object and what have you. But the version of the Bible that he's reading, which may be in Spanish, I'm not entirely sure, has gone through a period of we're actually going to talk about this later, gone through a period of translations out of their original, if we're talking about the Old Testament, in medieval Hebrew, up through the years, probably into Greek and back to various places, all the way back to where we are now into a language very far away from where it was originally written. So, yeah, I mean, sure, it would make sense if the person who was translating it needed a word that sounded like Earth and they just chose globe, but that doesn't say anything about the authenticity
of the Bible itself.
And there were people that predated the writing, the authorship of the Bible, who knew that the world was round.
Oh, yeah. Eratosthenes.
Eratosthenes figured this out. And it doesn't really prove anything, the fact that the Bible got it wrong in another place. I mean, again, that's the same sort of thing you get with again, like the Spider-Man example, is you have a character or a book that's written by multiple authors. You're going to get, inevitably, contradictions.
Right.
So,
Speaking of contradictions, we'll talk more about those later also.
Certainly.
You want to go for another one?
Do we want to go for another email?
Actually, let's break into news.
Let's go into news really quick. Yeah. This is something, this actually comes from Newsweek. Warrior Imam, the Kremlin's poster boy for moderate Islam, may be radicalizing the region. Now, the video shows a gun barrel jutting from the rear window of a shiny black Lada sedan as it cruises down Putin Prospect, the new boulevard of designer shops in the Chechen capital, Grozny. Spotting a pair of young women in long skirts but without headscarves, the vehicle's occupants open fire. The two pedestrians scream. They don't fall. A blot of red paintball ink is spreading across one young woman's blouse. As the vehicle pulls away, the camera shows two women dashing for safety into the nearest shop. Chechnya's enforcers of the supposed Islamic propriety have struck again. In the name of combating terrorism, President Ramzan Kadyrov has declared war on what he regards as public indecency. My dream is for all women to wear headscarves. In accordance with Islamic law, he told Newsweek recently, to assist in the fight against correct supposed un-Islamic conduct, he established his own Taliban-style morality police, the Center for Spiritual and Moral Development and Education. The region has resisted Moscow's control for centuries, but in the past decade or so, violence has spread and intensified as Islamist extremism has flourished everywhere elsewhere in the world. This year, suicide bombers killed more than 40 people in the Moscow subway and more than 150 in a series of attacks in North Caucasus. Basically, we're talking about somebody here who believes that their religion gives them the right to attack other people. And he tries to deny that any sort of people working for him are the ones shooting paintballs at women who show skin or not wearing a headscarf in accordance with their religious laws. However, he doesn't denounce it either. And clearly, I think he's also helped creating an environment where this sort of stuff can spread. I mean, he's actually assaulting people with a paintball gun, these people, because they won't follow their religious laws. I mean, this is just insane.
Right. I mean, the part of the article I didn't catch, if it's necessarily going to be escalating, but you would imagine that when you create a tolerant atmosphere of a sort of more moderate type of abuse, that then you would expect it to start to escalate. Because it often does. I mean, when you allow bullying to happen, it will only get serious and more widespread. If you tolerate assault on people, it will only get worse.
I also think it's worth mentioning that this guy is held up, at least by Putin and Medvedev, as being sort of this this pillar of what he considers moderate Islam. I think we need to talk about why is the bar for what's considered moderate Islam so low? That, I mean, yes, these people aren't strapping bombs to themselves and blowing up people in a marketplace, and they're not beheading people screaming Allahu Akbar. However, where in the United States, let's just take this same thing, and this is what we talked about last week, is applying terminology equally to multiple things. If we're going to use the word moderate for somebody who feels the need to sort of force these laws on people, would we consider a moderate Christian somebody like, say, Pat Robertson? This is worse than Pat Robertson, because even Pat Robertson isn't sending young people out into the streets to harass women who aren't obeying their religious laws, or let alone shoot them with a paintball gun.
Right. I mean, I don't know. I'm totally exasperated by the fact that this exists and that people seem to view this as a triumph of this restraint. I just I don't know. I don't think that public humiliation is necessarily the a signpost of a society getting more tolerant. I think that means that it's... certainly if this is replacing murdering people in the streets for doing that, I would suppose on the short term it's better. But I don't think the public humiliation is, like I said, the cornerstone of a society getting more mature and less likely to tolerate assault and violence.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily call it better. I just call it less bad, because yeah. I would never call shooting, you know, assaulting somebody with a paintball gun versus assaulting them with, you know, a pistol that actually fires real bullets, lethal weapon. That's not better. That's just less bad. The same way that me stabbing somebody on the street is less. It would, you know, that's bad, but it wouldn't be, it'd just be less bad for me just to beat the crap out of somebody unprovoked.
Right.
I wouldn't say, oh, well, we're making great strides. We're no longer stabbing people anymore.
Right. Yeah, Chechnya certainly has its problems, for sure. And I think what we're seeing is regression, not progression. I think this is just a veneer.
Yeah, it says, Kadyrov vigorously promotes his brand of Islam as what he calls the evil so-called denomination Wahhabism. He's lobbying the Kremlin to place all Russian muftis under the supervisor of Chechen imams, who would draft sermon covering religious and political issues to be taught to all Russian mosques. So basically, we're talking about complete breakdown of church and state.
Right.
That we're telling government employees straight out, these are the political and religious views that you must take. And to violently, you know, enforce those on other people, whether they hold your religious beliefs or not. So... yeah, fun stuff. What have you got?
Well, we'll pick on Islam a little bit more. So this is from CNN. The headline is, Court in United Arab Emirates says beating wife, child okay if no marks are left. And I think we've heard stories about this before.
Yeah.
A court in the United Arab Emirates says a man is permitted under Islamic law to physically discipline his wife and children as long as he leaves no marks and has tried other methods of punishment, the country's top court ruled. The ruling came in a case of a man who slapped his wife and slapped and kicked his 23-year-old daughter. The court ruled that a man has the right to punish his wife and children. This includes beating them after he has tried other options, such as admonition and then abstaining from sleeping with his wife, which
I think it's hilarious.
It's not much of a punishment.
You're punishing your wife by withholding sex from her.
Right. Well, I don't. I mean,
where does anyone think that would work?
I think the.
I
think within Islamic patriarchy societies, I think that they actually think that that's some sort of punishment, but in reality, it's not really a punishment. It goes on to say that several experts in Islamic law say that it's against the law to permit wife beating. However, this expert, was it Hashim Brown, said he feels confident that the UAE court didn't sanction injury abuse. He said that Sharia law is complex and is open to interpretation. So does that mean it's... That's the part that's the most difficult for me to get about, especially when you're taking religious doctrine and inscribing it into actual law. Is it always permitted, or is it permitted or not permitted? Which one?
Is it open to interpretation or is it not? Because it's not like I can be brought before a Sharia court and go, oh, well, I just used the reason another way, so you can't enforce that. Either it's enforceable law or it's not. But the minute you actually have official courts that can jail or kill or beat you, that's the point where, no, it isn't open to interpretation anymore.
Well, I mean, even within this story, you've seen the distinction between the judges themselves who are attempting to basically... So this guy got in trouble because he took it a little bit too far, essentially. He got punished, he got some sort of slap on the wrist because he beat them a little bit too much. But it's okay to beat them. And then another Islamic scholar says, it's argued that in Islamic law, it is, quote, absolutely unlawful to abuse a wife, injure her, or insult her dignity. So,
oh yeah, because apparently, you know, honor killings and forcing her to wear a cloth bag with an ice in it—that isn't an attack on her dignity.
So I don't know. I mean, this ends up being my problem entirely with fundamentalism and societies that consider religious doctrine to be totally inerrant, which is you either have to say that it's true and follow it by the letter, or you have to have a way in which it can be interpreted that allows for, I don't know, that allows for interpretation. It's either 100% static or it's not. It can't be both.
Yeah, that's the weird thing with religion, is because you can't prove any of this stuff. Right. It just comes down to everyone's separate interpretation, and they're like, oh, well, that's clearly wrong, because they're just applying their own sense of morality on it. It's just nonsense. That's just simply why religion shouldn't have any sort of government power to punish, jail, or kill anyone.
Right.
Period.
Speaking of punishing or jailing anyone, if you want to call us and chide us for speaking ill of religion, 206-421-5658. We want to hear what you have to say about it.
Definitely.
Or if you just want to register your indignance.
Indignance.
Indignation.
So, yeah, we just have one last news story. This is something that actually comes a little bit closer to home than the United Arab Emirates. this one actually comes from Patterson, California. This was put up by Hemet Mehta on his blog, The Friendly Atheist. Atheist city council candidate is subject of attempted smear campaign. James Leonard is running for city council campaign in Patterson, California, a city of just over 20,000 people. It's a local race, so you wouldn't think that the vitriol would get that hard. But the opposition heard that Leonard was an atheist, and they sent out this mailer, if you can bring up that magic image. It comes under the headline, Character Matters. And as you can see there, they've got background information on the scary, godless heathen in their
right, things. I love how it's this, how they point to his status on Facebook.
His status on Facebook. Oh, and it says...
Oh, my God, Facebook!
They've got definitions. I don't know why they have anti-theism right next to it in parentheses, as if it needs to be explained.
That, anti-theism.
Yeah, yes. It's... so yes, a person who shows there is no God. Yeah, and then they say they mention that he includes two of his favorite books on there, which is, you know, God Is Not Great by Christopher Hitchens and The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins. It says, do the citizens of Patterson really want an atheist, anti-theist representing our community? By voting for James Leonard, you're voting for a person who, as an anti-theist, atheist, not only does not believe in God, and I love that underline. Bring that image up again, because it's so beautiful. Does not believe in God! Underlined there. But he's opposed to the belief in the evidence of a God. Well, no, I'm sure he'd be happy if there actually was some evidence. A belief in God is what our nation and community is based on. No, it's not. It's really, really not. Our community and our country are based on the idea of secularism, the idea that the government doesn't have the right to enforce its belief, or it doesn't have the right to a belief. The government does not have a freedom of religion. Individual people have a freedom of religion and expression. The government is an artificial entity that's here to represent all of us. And the way it does that effectively, and this is written right into the Constitution, by not respecting or prohibiting expressions of religion. That means you don't take sides on things, you don't take opposition to things, period, including our side. So I think that's amazing how many religious people don't seem to get this. We did have a Christian a few weeks ago who did get this, and we just beg those people. So if you're a theist out there who does understand the value of the separation of church and state, you really got to talk to your other theists. It can't just be us. It can't just be us talking about this, because it protects everybody. Period. Yeah.
I'll just say, as a personal note, it would be great if we had a time in the political environment where it would be okay for you to be an atheist, and how it wouldn't necessarily be a strike against you, or disqualify you outright, which for most races of import, it disqualifies you outright.
I actually would like to get to the point. That's like, I don't want to get to the point where this becomes like an atheist country with atheist laws. I don't want any of that. I certainly wouldn't vote for somebody simply because they were an atheist. Yeah. What I would like to get is to the point where, say, the UK is in their last election that they have, the last general election, the candidate of the Liberal Democrats Party, Nick Clegg, is an atheist. And his atheism was a total non-issue in the campaign. Nobody cared about it. That's what I'd like to get to. I'd like to get to the point where it just becomes a non-issue. That unless your beliefs are pushing you to do something really stupid, like deny scientific evidence for, say, evolution or the age of the world or something like that, or, I don't believe in global warming because God said he wouldn't drown the planet again. That's basically a quote from a congressman. That's the sort of stuff that does affect your policy, but simply lack of belief in a God or belief in a God, I really don't care. Provided that you're not trying to push that on other people.
Right.
Period. It says this was an attempt to make Leonard look bad, but it doesn't really work when he admits to the charge without a blink, right? Other candidates might try to fight it when opponents call them an atheist, but Leonard proudly admits it is true. He's an atheist, and there's nothing wrong with that. And this is a quote from James Leonard. Yes, I am an atheist. I was raised by a wonderful, open-minded parents who did not subscribe to a particular religion, and who did not go to church. In my younger years, I believed in God simply because that's what everyone else seemed to believe. After years of thinking, reading, and questioning, I have come to the belief that there is no God, and I am comfortable with that belief and all of its ramifications. Whoever was behind this ad launched their attack in total anonymity, possibly even violating political campaign finance laws to do it. That's not character as far as I'm concerned. I have never kept my beliefs a secret, but as a candidate, I have felt in my heart that this was a non-issue. I believe that what religion a person follows has no bearing on their qualifications for public office, and I have therefore never sought to make an issue out of my non-belief. And it's worth mentioning the local paper, the Patterson Irrigator, had some information.
The Irrigator. That's awesome.
So I guess it's a dry region.
Water is the most important commodity.
Yes. They have some information on who might have sent out the mailer. The creator of the mailer tried to place the same advertisement in the Irrigator earlier this month. The person identified him or herself as Tom Jefferson.
Of course.
Their real name.
That's a great name.
Emailed the newspaper on October 5th about running a half-page political ad in the newspaper. The Irrigator responded that they would need full contact information before they could run the ad. An unknown woman then dropped off $306.15 in cash for the advertisement later that afternoon.
Weird.
But the advertisement did not receive a copy of the ad until later that evening. The Irrigator chose not to run the advertisement after running it, as the newspaper was apparently not aware of who produced it. The person who produced the advertisement and gave it to the newspaper has not yet retrieved the money that they paid for it. And if the person does not do so, the Irrigator publisher Bob Matthews said the new paper will simply return the money over to the state.
That's interesting.
So they're not even willing to stand up in public and say, right, I'm a bigot against atheists or something. Right. They shouldn't be allowed to hold public office. Anyways, we actually do have a caller, Majid from Kirkland. How are you doing today?
Yes, fine. Thanks so much. I'm just calling to say that I really appreciate the way you are talking to people and giving them information. And but in our country, Iran, not only religion is running everything, but they are killing people.
Oh,
they
yes.
are torturing people. They are really destroying the country.
Absolutely.
And it reminds me of, you know, the Middle Ages of the religion's power. Anytime religion gets into power, that is the end of a nation.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, I mean,
and,
I think
that's... I really, really appreciate what you are doing.
Oh, I appreciate it, too.
I'm sure in this country... we were lucky that we came here. In this country, also, there are religious people who try to meddle into the government affairs. But
absolutely.
Fortunately, you have it in your constitution that it should be separate.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, you totally understand it, Majid, and that's, I think, the beauty and why we, as you know, some of us who are Americans, who really, obviously, we've lived here, maybe we've been elsewhere. The one of the things that you can love about this country, despite all of its flaws, is the fact that it's a place that allows people to have different beliefs, and for that not to be a liability for their life or their freedom or their family's safety.
Because I think that's really what the definition of freedom is, where it's safe to be different. Where you can simply, like you said, people are killed over this sort of stuff, and it's insane. And I think that a lot of times people who are in... I have something I tend to refer to as majoritarian arrogance, that somebody's in the majority, whether they're a Muslim in the Middle East or a Christian in the United States, don't really appreciate church-state separation because they're so used to just having their way on everything. Mm. And they're so used to their beliefs basically being forced upon people as the default that they just get sort of angry and defensive whenever anyone else wants to affirm the same rights to express themselves as they do.
Yeah, they don't allow it.
Yeah, it's amazing because they'll want to have like a prayer before a city council meeting, but if it's a prayer from a different religion, usually the people that are most gung-ho about pushing their own prayer are the first ones to basically throw a fit if somebody else wants that same right.
Right.
That is true. That's true. I hope one day we can get the same freedom as you have it here regarding the religion.
I hope so.
A lot of people are really suffering. Millions of people are suffering in our country right now.
Greater Persia is...
All educated people are suffering, and most of them are in prison under torture.
Yeah, it's scary.
If you say you don't believe in God, that's the end of your life.
Right.
They kill you.
I'm glad to hear this perspective, Majid, because Iran is one of, for me personally, is one of the most fascinating places on the planet because so much of the history of Western civilization was has taken place through there directly or indirectly, and it's a great tragedy that because of the way that certain political or ideological forces have made it so, our country has to be at such at odds with them, and also their state happens to be at odds with the people within their own country. I don't share sort of George Bush's messianic vision about the spread of democracy, making everyone free, but I certainly do hope for a resolution sometime in the next few decades that opens Iran up for more ideological and political freedom, you know.
Absolutely.
I would love to go there.
During the previous government,
oh, serious
during
government?
The previous government, we had dictatorship, but not religion. Now it is dictatorship and religion together. It is unbelievable.
Right.
Yeah.
What people are suffering.
Right. Yeah. When religion gets political power, censorship seems to be the inevitable conclusion. Is that when you have a government based around an idea that is unquestionable, like I think Scott even said this, that science has answers that
That's
may never
right.
be questioned, and
right.
religion has questions that may never be answered. The easiest way to do that is just to hold on to this sort of power based on this sort of non-evidence-based faith is to legally and physically prevent people from asking those sort of questions
right.
and starting the conversation, because it's those conversations that break down religion's power. So they try to prevent it at any cost. So anyways, it was really good to hear from you, Majid, and thank you for calling
in. Thank you
in.
So much.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
Keep up the good work.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
So let's.
That was awesome.
That was awesome.
I was just going to say, it's interesting that Majid called and he said that he is originally from Iran because, was it last week?
Yes.
Last week or the week before, we had someone call in from Tehran, inexplicably, who didn't have time to talk.
Yeah, that didn't work.
Yeah, he couldn't wait to talk to us. So that's an interesting question.
Yeah, it's nice to know that even in a country where there is that kind of control over the sort of information and opinions people are allowed to hear, that people find a way to still hear those different information. Because that's really what breaks down totalitarian mindsets, period, is the ability to just be different, to be different. I just want to get to the point where they're able to be different safely.
Right.
And sadly, there doesn't seem to be, I mean, you can't do it the George Bush way. You can't just simply go into a country, someone else's country, and sort of force it by, you know, the point of a gun.
Right.
It's going to have to come internally. That, I mean, something closer to the Green Movement, which still isn't secular, but
right.
I really do think that it's going to be the people of Iran that fix Iran.
Right.
And it's going to be a really, really painful, drawn-out process. And please be strong. The same thing happened under Christianity like 500 years ago.
Yeah.
So it will happen. It just will be very painful. Ask Galileo.
Well, shall we move on to the topic? I know
Let's
we're,
move right into
we've
the
been
topic.
Burning down the minutes here. So I wanted to talk specifically about the Synoptic Gospels. And for those of you who are mystified why atheists would want to be talking about this, I think we've said this before, this sort of stuff, while I don't believe a lick of it, is fascinating to me. I mean, the Bible is arguably the most influential book in all of Western civilization. It is the foundation for the most powerful and largest religion in the entire world. And when we are making criticisms on the show about theists, we're largely talking about Christians. So for us to do this and not, for us to make those criticisms and not actually understand theologically, historically, what the book and the foundations, the religious foundations, would be remiss. We would be remiss. So I want to talk specifically about the Synoptic Gospels, which are the first four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, because they are not only our earliest Gospels that were written, but also they're the ones that have basically the only, as far as we know and as for what we take for granted, the only information that we have about Jesus's life. So if there is information that is to be said as the closest to represent the man for whom the entire religion is based, then the first four Gospels are it. They're basically all we have, as we don't have any secular sources. So what are the Gospels specifically? Well, they're the first four books of the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They were written, as I said, written closest to the life of Jesus, and they contain what might be the only likely words of the man Jesus himself. and they largely inspired, those books themselves and the oral traditions from which they came inspired not only the entire religion of Christianity, but they also went on to inspire the later books in the New Testament and inspired what later became the canon to make the what we know now as the New Testament. So they were alleged, the first thing to know about these things is we call them Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, because the presumption is that these are actually eyewitness testimonies by disciples of the same name. So, you know, if you were in a court of law, you would be, you know, and you wanted to ask someone about an incident, you would favor the person who saw it with their own eyes rather than the person who heard it from their neighbor, who heard it from someone else who saw it. So, as in antiquity and as in certain places now in history, now in present day, you would favor, if you were wanting to tell someone about an incident, someone who was as an eyewitness or as close to an eyewitness as possible. So there's definitely, that's the claim behind them, the Gospels according to Matthew, the Gospel according to Luke, and what have you. So while these are purported to be disinterested historical accounts, depending on the way you're looking at it, they are all at once a work of ancient literature collectively. They are a biography and a historical record, as well as theological doctrine themselves. So, and depending on which context you actually want to look at them, you can speak different ways and you can find different interpretations of the way the text goes. So the first that we won't talk about at all, because we're not a televangelist show. We're not in church. This is not our job to find meaning in the Gospels, is the theological context. And that's the doctrinal basis of the Christian religion, one that contains the theological, the Christology, as they would call it, about the man himself, the divine figure Jesus, some sort of interpretation or explanation as to what all this means in God's greater plan, as well as these also have predictions about what's going to happen with to the future of the world. And these are all things that are firmly ensconced in a theological reading.
They're all faith-based.
Right, exactly. They're all things that you can't take the predictions when Jesus says, I tell you now that there are no among you that will not taste, well, that will taste death because you will see the end of the earth. That's purely a theological claim.
Yeah.
You certainly can't test that at all.
Yeah, how did that work out, by the way?
As we'll see later, actually, the Gospels, the author of the latest Gospel actually had to deal with that problem. That was particularly thorny.
Because, I mean, as far as I can remember, the world did not end in the first century.
No. It's as far as I know.
I'm not a historian, but...
So the
still
second,
here.
Other than theological, which we won't talk about for obvious reasons, there is looking at the Gospels through a historical context, which is also somewhat fascinating for anyone who's a student of history who likes to know about what lives were like under different people at different times under different circumstances. So obviously this is a narrative about a people in a time and a place. First century Judeans. It was largely about a Jewish community that was. That was sort of intertwined, that was in the Roman Empire under Roman rule. And it was about living in Mediterranean antiquity. So there were all these sort of things that differ from our own perspective that are informed by history, and that if you read these alongside Roman historians and whatnot, you would actually have a better picture of what it was like to be in that part of the Mediterranean at that time.
But in a weird sort of way, we're still going to get back to the Sherlock Holmes Spider-Man sort of thing, is that
right.
Just because it was written in that certain era and it matches a lot of things because the author is from that time and these are real places, it doesn't do anything to verify the supernatural claims in these stories.
No, and that's why largely I won't talk a lot about the historical Jesus, but the people, the scholars who have a study around finding the historical Jesus, and that is, you know, trying to determine what if Jesus was a real person, which is an openly debatable point.
Yeah, because there is no contemporary eyewitness evidence.
No.
I mean, these things. What is written about him is generally written by followers of Jesus long after he's supposed to death.
And the few secular sources we have are basically accounts of historians basically saying, oh yeah, there are these people called Christians, and they worshipped a guy named Christ who they thought was divine.
And that was Josephus there?
Flavius Josephus was the first, the earliest mention, and then there was a Roman historian that's name is escaping me right now who talked about people who were named Christians. So it's
totally doesn't say a lot.
So yeah, I mean we know about the existence of Christians existed because they exist now. Obviously, that's not very controversial. But other than the historical context, that to me is not necessarily as interesting as looking at the Bible in a literary context. In looking that that it is the successor to the first literary Western religion, which was Judaism. Judaism was unique among other ancient religions in that it was a bookish religion, meaning they actually bothered to take their holy doctrine and write it down and keep this tradition with them, and they would slowly improve on them with the laws and what have you. The Law and the Prophets? The interpretations that came after the law. That was fairly unique. And the fact that the New Testament then carries on this tradition of being this written tradition where, although this was to be decided later with canon, it was where these traditions themselves were saved and collected together and made into a large body of authoritative work, that sets it apart as it is also a work of literature as well. They were all written by... They're not all of them, but they were written by different authors. Paul is largely accredited with writing a great number of them, but they weren't all written by the same person. They weren't written by the hand of God or Jesus. They were partially sourced from common text sources that we no longer survive that are also either derived directly or indirectly from oral tradition, because this is the way that stories got passed down in antiquity, because most people were illiterate. They were written for different audiences, and they were also written in a language that really was not spoken, read, or understood by the people who lived in those events. So the first earliest copies of the Bible were undoubtedly in Greek, although people in Judea who were Jewish spoke Aramaic. That's the interesting part about about this entire thing is although it was alleged to have been written by the disciples Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they were peasant, illiterate fishermen and other people who had jobs and who had jobs but didn't require any real education. So the fact that for to require someone to have known how to read as well as write Greek to assemble these stories as part of one of the eyewitnesses makes it highly unlikely that these are homonymous, which is, written by the same author as it is credited with. It makes it highly unlikely that these are homonymous books.
They're more written in the name of something rather than, this isn't the actual disciple who wrote this.
There's a $5 word called pseudepigraphic, which is exactly describing that. A book that is claimed to have been written by one person, but really is written by another. Also called a forgery.
I think George W. Bush has a book like that. Peggy Noonan actually wrote.
Well, at least these are a little bit different in that the authors who wrote them decided to ascribe them to earlier works either out of respect for the tradition or in an attempt to gain more authenticity to the narrative itself.
I find it sort of funny, too, in the question of what language these texts were written in, that the Vatican, especially for the longest time, demanded that they be written in Latin,
right.
And clearly that isn't the original language
and
that these things are from.
And most of the translations of the Bible that we had in the West came from the Latin Vulgate, which was an all-Latin version of the Old and New Testament that had been around for hundreds and hundreds of years, but when they actually started in the 19th century, when they actually started going back and trying to find the earliest sources, trying to pick them out, they found that the Latin the Vulgate was one of the ones that contained the most errors out of the surviving sources, where there were Greek assemblages that were a little more correct, historically correct.
So essentially we have basically a really long game of telephone.
Right, and we'll definitely get to that when we talk about that. But the last thing to sort of understand about the Bible as in this literary context is that it survives now as a series of books that were copied dozens, if not hundreds of times over their lifetime between different languages. And in each of those copyings, they were subject to either innocent errors, copying errors, just regular human errors, to motivated and malicious changes. So there was all these things that happened that we now have no record of, other than the fact that we've got an early source here that survived, and there's some changes between our earlier sources, and we really don't know what's original. We can sort of work around and try to see what's original, but we don't. So what I really want to address with these, and this is I'm stealing entirely from Bart Ehrman, who's got a great book called Jesus Interrupted. where he talks about the tradition, literary traditions of the book itself, is that, you know, while I reject wholeheartedly the theological and truth claims of most of these books, I think that they are far more interestingly some sort of have some value as historical accounts and have even more value as looking as far as a foundation for our Western culture, because obviously you can't, like, for example, Western philosophy, you can't help but have to be in on the joke, have to know exactly about the Christian mythology and the books to understand larger points that authors are trying to make.
Well, there's a lot of literary references too that get made. You call somebody a Judas goat, or you call someone a good Samaritan. I mean,
right.
These are all phrases that have biblical origins.
Right.
And I think on some level it's impossible to understand a lot of Western literature without having a basic understanding of the Bible, at least.
Right.
Where you know where a lot of phrases come from, what this is a metaphor for.
Right. So it looks like we're totally burning the daylight hours here. The three points that he wanted to get by were specifically is that, one, because of the fact that these were all written by different people, and if you actually set down the title, didn't have a good way to illustrate this to you guys, but if you set them out, if you read it horizontally, which is basically you take the texts themselves and you lay the passages side by side when they're talking about, you know, for example,
whether the Last Supper happened before or after Passover.
Right. You could basically, by finding, because they all share the same source, they share lots of the same sources. For example, this is one part that I wanted to get to. If we look at a textual analysis of the Gospels themselves, there are you get a bulk of the tradition from the text of the Book of Mark, which is the earliest source. And also from this lost source that we call Q, which is from, I believe it's Quelle is the name you say it. It's a German word for source. Biblical scholars say that Q is this lost source of text by which large portions of Matthew and Luke take from word for word. So actually, if you lay down various parts of stories next to each other, they match almost exactly in almost all places, and they match very closely to Mark. So these were sources that were related. And of course, there were some literary sources unique to Matthew and Luke themselves, and those were given the monikers of M and L. And then John is based on a much, much later tradition. But essentially what you have is that they're all, of course, working from the same root oral tradition, because obviously someone carried on the life and stories of Jesus Christ after he died through oral traditions. But then you have these now non-existent textual sources for which what we see now is a pastiche of you're grabbing this from here and these two are shared here, this one differs a little, and then some of these are some strange tradition that we don't have any source for. Like, for example, there's the story that is most biblical scholars say is can't have been original, which is the story about the woman, the prostitute, being stoned to death. Mm-hmm. Essentially, that was one of the, I believe it was the one that gives, for he who is without sin cast the first stone. By looking back on earlier versions of the Bible, biblical scholars say that this was this was definitely an addition to the text. It was not part of the original text. So, yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
I just want to say we also have a voicemail line. If we could bring that up again real quick. We had it up a little bit earlier. Maybe closer to the end of the show where we can't actually do any more live calls, but we have a voicemail line. And it's 206-420-0997. Leave us a call, and we can definitely address your points. We can even play the call over the air next time. Definitely.
Right. So the last thing I had written down here, because there's so much more that I could go through here. I mean, the points that Ehrman wants to get across that I think are the most important is that, one, that the Bible as an inerrant text can't be true because it contains too many of its own. It's too self-contradictory if it's supposed to be a literal history. And that, two, each author speaks for himself. Each book of the Synoptic Gospels, as well as each book of the rest of the New Testament, is done by a different author for a different community, and it wants to tell the same story but tell it differently. And thirdly, the most important is that looking at it from a historical perspective, these can't be disinterested historical accounts, because each person taking these traditions and writing them down and carrying them forward has an agenda for doing so, and it largely, since these were written for various communities, these are largely ways to preserve the tradition, but as well as to interpret the tradition to help resolve some of the issues that the communities themselves might be having over
time. It's a way of selling it to a certain group. It's kind of like how Christianity in Europe adopted a lot of the pagan traditions from Saturnalia to convert people.
Correct. And I think the interesting part about here is that what we do find in to combat this sort of the weird errors between the inconsistencies between these stories is these apologetics, which is this whole field of trying to find a way to reconcile the fact that, say, Jesus died before Passover and after Passover, and you called it the
no prize for Jesus. Right. The general gist, if you're not familiar with what a no prize is, Marvel Comics used to do this thing where if a reader would call in and find a way to rationalize a continuity error, let's just say Spider-Man's eating a Reuben sandwich and in some old issue he said he hated Reuben sandwiches, and they make some excuse for why this still fits. It's different in a lot of ways for Marvel Comics simply because nobody who's coming up with these excuses really thinks Spider-Man is real. At least I hope not. the difference here is that really, and Sam put this out too, is apologetics largely exists not to try to convince other people of continuity errors, but largely to combat doubt within oneself. Largely, it's one of the most dishonest things I've seen, because the reasons they give for why other people should believe these things, even with the contradictions, aren't the reasons they believe. So
yeah, and so apologetics can be distasteful to a lot of people and some fun to bandy around for us. But I guess to conclude here of where I'm sort of taking this analysis from is not that I really care about what is historically true and untrue. I mean,
I do care.
I mean, let's just put it this way. It doesn't matter to me whether or not Jesus existed or didn't exist.
That I can agree with.
What matters is the fact that there are people that are credulous enough to believe that all the things that the Bible says are true. What our goal here should be to do is to continue to we gotta call out. Sorry.
Anyways,
The Bible is awesome. You should read it.
not really true though. We are going to be meeting in just a short while at the Northgate Azteca. Join us for some food, some fun conversation. We continue this conversation soon. We do want to thank you here at Ask an Atheist. We'll be here next Sunday to discuss all sorts of topics. Come down, have a beer with us. See you next week.
Thanks, guys. Bye bye.